success of the TV series meant that Hollywood stars were soon fighting to climb aboard the bandwagon. The show boasted appearances by Joan Collins, Otto Preminger, Sammy Davis Jr., Woody Allen, Shelley Winters, Liberace, George Sanders, Ethel Merman, and Vincent Price. It created its own mythology with hit props like the bat phone and the bat pole.
One time I went down the bat pole, and I landed on something curious, and it felt fleshy. And I thought, oh my God, and it was a strange odor of Midnight Express cheap wine. Of course, I knew the odor of that. And there was a guy down there, a wino, at the bottom, you know, where we hit the end of the pole on a mattress, and he'd found a nice, cozy place to sleep the night away, and I went right on top of him.
And of course, he had the coolest car on TV.
The Batmobile was probably the hardest car to drive because although it looked great on film, with all those labels and the chutes that come out the back to stop it, and the bat U-turn and the fire from the back end. The suspension was really bad and the brakes were awful. And then there was the bat cycle, and poor Bert Robin had to ride in the sidecar. Now I, as Batman, would push a button and the sidecar would immediately go off on its own as if it were radio programmed or whatever to go where I wanted it to go with Robin. Well, poor Bert never knew where the sidecar would end up. And he would go off screaming and twisting and careening toward some horrible mass, and the guys in the crew would be yelling, help, get out, get out of here. It was fun.
The show also gave Adam West the chance to try his hand at the pop world. Have a listen to this.
I never met a girl like you before, Miranda.
Miranda.
And I'd do anything for you if you just ask,
Miranda.
That was Miranda. And if you thought that was groovy, then have a listen to this.
Things you always wanted to know about Batman, but were afraid to ask, part 3. Thank you for the music.
For some bizarre reason, musicians, and tragically many non-musicians, seem strangely attracted to the Batman. Over the past 30 years, there have been over 60 albums connected with the character, from film soundtracks to spoken word records, and over 50 singles. And here for you now are just a few of these musical gems. There's been a truckload of versions of the famous theme, written by Neil Hefti and arranged by Nelson Riddler, from Jen and Dean, to the Marquettes, to the Kinks, and the Who, and this belter by the Jam. And that's about as good as it gets, because after that, what's left? Who could forget this from Christmas 1966, Mike and Bernie Winters, with That Man, Batman.
I like Father Christmas, and I like Robin Hood.
Oh, Robin Hood.
I like Andy Pandy, and the wooden tops are very good. But I love
Frank Gorshin tried his hand at this tune, The Riddler.
Riddle me this!
What, tell me, what, tell me, what's the difference between an elephant and a flea?
Gee, we would sure like to know the difference between an elephant and a flea.
Well, an elephant can have fleas, but a flea can't have elephants. Oh.
The record that takes the teeth-rotting biscuit is this. Produced by Frank Zappa, who should have known better, and featuring the silver-tongued charm of Robin himself, Burt Ward, this is Boy Wonder, I Love You.
Hi, kids. It's me, your pal, the Boy Wonder. Taking this opportunity to catch up on my fan mail. really hard to read all the tons of mail I get. Here is a happy letter.
Unfortunately, Boy Wonder, I Love You was not released in Britain. And, garbage though it undoubtedly was, it may surprise you to learn that a copy of that record will now set you back about £100. The TV show ended after its third season, and the studios immediately put all 120 episodes into reruns. To this day, the Batman show appears on a TV set somewhere in the world every single minute of the day. The demise of the show soon sent the comic book into a steady tailspin. But slowly during the 70s, thanks to writer Denny O'Neill and artist Neil Adams, the Bat began to claw his way back.
Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams came in and sorted out the character and returned him to his dark roots. In the late 60s and the early 70s, you do get the start of a new Batman, a very different art style, epitomised by Neil Adams, who's quite, you know, more realistic than any other Batman we've seen. People always kind of, you know, talking about the dark Batman, and that can often be a generalisation, but I think it's fairly true to say that the 70s was a far darker Batman than the comics of the late 1960s. And Robin, of course, went off to college as well, so that changes the mythos when Batman's on his own a lot more without Robin.
While Denny O'Neill was returning the Batman to his dark roots, future Batman writers were learning their trade. One of them was British writer Alan Grant.
A good friend of mine, John Wagner, and his partner Pat Mills were actually putting 2000 AD together, that they asked me if I was interested in trying my hand at comic strip. It wasn't for 2000 AD actually, it was to take over a contract which they had signed but didn't have time to do the work on for the character of Tarzan. Anyway, I progressed from there to working freelance for 2000 AD. In partnership with John Wagner, we were writing characters like Judge Dredd, Johnny Alpha, Strontium Dog, Sam Slade, Robo Hunter. And totally out of the blue, in I think it was early 1987, I had a call from Denny O'Neill, who had just taken over as the editor of the Batman comics. He told me that circulations were plummeting rapidly. They were thinking of closing down Batman and Detective Comics, which was the oldest comic in DC stable. And as a last-ditch attempt, they wanted to hire Wagner and I to try and bring some of the sensibility of Judge Dredd to the Batman character. We agreed to do a two-part test story, which introduced our new characters, the Ventriloquist and Scarface, who've since become staples in the Batman universe. And after that first two-parter, Denny called up and said, okay, the job's yours. And 11 years later, I guess I'm still doing it. The first Batman comic I saw, I must have been 4 years old, sitting on my grandmother's knee. My grandmother used to look after me, and she spent much of the time teaching me to read using comic books. We had relations in America who used to send us Batman comics. Well, I guess he was a good guy who went after the bad guys, basically, although he looked pretty like a bad guy himself, which I'm sure is a large part of his appeal. The symbol of the bat is recognized throughout the world as a bad luck symbol, except in China, where they view it as good fortune. But countries throughout the world have got very strange customs concerning bats. Some European countries nail live bats to the front door of houses on certain nights of the year in order to keep the evil spirits away. And in most cultures of the world, the bat is looked on as a symbol of death. So it was a very potent symbol that Bob Kane chose. And of course, to a four-year-old, it was just something cool to look at.
By the 1980s, comics were starting to undergo a critical reappraisal, and a writer called Frank Miller was about to take the hero somewhere he'd never been before, respectability. Miller wrote two treatments of the Batman. The first, The Dark Knight Returns, was his version of a final Batman story, while the second tale, Year One, was a classic retelling of the Caped Crusader's origin.
He is trained with the best in their field, from unarmed combat to forensics, from surveillance to aeronautics. From swordplay to sign language, he has mastered every discipline. But still, the instrument of his vengeance escapes him. How will he deliver his justice? His question is met with a crash of broken glass as a large bat smashes through a window at Wayne Manor. Terrible in the dark, the shock of the black-winged intruder gives him the idea he needs to complete his transformation. His justice will be tempered with fear. He will terrify his foes. After all, criminals are a cowardly and superstitious lot. So, he will become a bat. A Batman.
Most of the basic assumptions of comics up until the past few years were all pretty much set in the 40s and then thoroughly castrated in the 50s, with a little bit sprinkled in the 60s of more contemporary issues. But essentially it was graven in stone. And in the 50s, and everything had to happen in a very benevolent world where you can always trust the cops, you can always trust your elected officials, you can always trust your parents. I think that it's unfortunate that for so many years the basic idea of superheroes was made impossible by putting it in a world where it didn't need any. I felt that there was no way to really do Batman without addressing the fact that, you know, at least at the start of the story, he's an anachronism. I mean, he's like Zorro. There's something very antiquated about the whole notion, and the effort of Dark Knight was to revive it.
Miller was determined to rescue the character from what he perceived as the laughable elements of the past four decades. Chip Kidd.
It was tremendously significant for many, many different reasons. The format said, this is something different. This is something new. This is taking a character that you thought you knew and completely changing your mind about him. He took everything about the character that was quintessential about it from the beginning and went back to it and enhanced it.
Batman Year One has everything that a Batman story should have. It didn't rely on supervillains, it didn't rely on technology, it was a character-driven story. And basically it was the story of how Batman, how he fared during his first year on the job. For me, it stood the test of time. I think he wrote it about 12 years ago. And it's still my favorite Batman story.
In the wake of Frank Miller's work, more and more writers were encouraged to stretch the boundaries of the books. Grant Morrison was to write one of the most disturbing stories the series had ever seen, Arkham Asylum.
In the Batman comics, there is a lunatic asylum called Arkham, where all the evil Batman villains are kept, like the Joker and Two-Face. So my idea was to do a story where Batman is kind of put into the asylum and has to acknowledge the fact that he might be as crazy as the people he fights. People were looking at the motivations behind superhero characters and thinking, what would it take to dress up as a bat? You need to be pretty sick in the head. So the characters were being psychoanalyzed, I guess, and I kind of took that concept to the max in Arkham Asylum, and the Batman character was almost psychoanalyzed out of existence.
Ordinary criminals find themselves in Blackgate Prison. But the really bad ones, the mad ones, the ones that are just too dangerous to know, were cast into the pit, which is Arkham Asylum. Arkham, the first stop on a long, slow trip to hell. A gothic dungeon full of screams and shadows and cold, cold laughter.
A year's research and then a month to write. So that was a big one, you know, that was a big 120 page book. A normal Batman comic maybe take about a week to write for me. Other people can do this stuff in a matter of hours. Is it sold 250,000 and we get a dollar on each. We'd never have got away with the stuff we did in Arkham Asylum now. I mean, 10 years ago it was a lot more experimental because experimental projects were selling big numbers. Now it's kind of, it's a lot more under control, and it's a lot more under the control of Warners, who are the corporate overseers of DC Comics. So yeah, I mean, definitely there's only so much that could be done there, and it's definitely not a time for experimentation, it seems.
The final battle for world bat domination took place where all the best wars are won, in Hollywood. In 1989, director Tim Burton was let loose on the bat legend and delivered the fifth biggest movie of all time, earning $400 million worldwide and grabbing two Oscars. The theme tune went to number one, and everyone quite literally read the book, saw the film, and bought the t-shirt.
Go, go, go with a smile!
I really do think it was the first Batman movie in 1989 that really brought Batman to the world's attention. I mean, yes, there was the 60s TV series and stuff, and everyone has heard of Batman, let's face it. But it really was the fact that there was, for the first time ever, a serious, high-budget, high-production-value movie that wasn't kind of Zap Kapow, that had some big star names in the cast. And, well, if for those of you that remember the hoopla surrounding the movie at the time, and it lasted for months and months afterwards, and Batman prices shot up through the roof, and suddenly comics were really, really cool.
After the first Batman film, the real die-hard comic fans all said, this isn't dark enough. They said the same thing about Judge Dredd, obviously, later on. This is the recurrent thing. Comics fans will go and see a movie. They go, it's not dark enough. It's not brutal enough. It's not strange enough. Why isn't it? It's because when a comic book is made, somebody sits down and draws it and writes it, and it gets published, and it costs X amount of money. When a movie gets made, it costs X times a million. And you cannot make that dark movie that we all want to see with that kind of budget. Then, you know, when Batman Returns came out, it was long and it was baggy, and yes, there was some, you know, slightly creepy and unpleasant stuff in it, but basically it was big set pieces. It was Danny DeVito being a penguin. There were some gags in it, and I don't, personally, although this is heresy in movie terms, I don't think the Batman movie series really hit its stride until Joel Schumacher took over, and you got, you know, Batman Forever and Batman and Robin. Now, everyone thinks Batman and Robin is the worst film ever made. I think it's a perfectly fine film because it's a film made by a guy who comes from costume design. That's what Joel Schumacher used to do. And Schumacher just took hold of the series and made it back into a kid's product. I don't think he did it and, you know, and undid the comic book. I think he did what movies do. It may be possible for somebody like James Cameron to make a great big dark gothic comic epic because Hollywood owes him one. But most people aren't going to be able to do that. And in the case of Batman, Tim Burton Batman, and Batman Returns, I think what you have is that struggle between light and dark, and it works. Okay, it's not as bad as Howard the Duck, but it only just holds itself together because it's not a comic book, it's a popcorn movie.
Thanks to Hollywood, the Batman is now omnipresent, his bat symbol recognised all over the world, and the comics read in countless countries by people of countless cultures. Why does he work as a character?
Well, I just noticed, I mean, while I've been doing the comics, obviously you spend a lot of time analysing this stuff and how the trends work, and I noticed that there are fairly big 20-year cycles, which tend to be dominated either by Superman or Batman. It's kind of interesting because those characters were the first two superhero characters created in 38 and 39. And obviously Superman represents the light and Batman represents the dark at the lowest level. And you notice that if you follow the progress through the 20-year cycles, Superman tends to be popular during times of economic disaster. And it tends to be because people are looking for father figures, so Superman comics always do well then. Batman comics, I noticed, do well when we're in times of economic success and vigour. And so you notice, like, during the yuppie times in the 80s, where the Batman movie was massive, during the 60s, Batman was massive. And right now we're coming to Superman time again, which is kind of authoritarian father figure stuff. So it's just, it's interesting, you can plot the way culture moves just using these two figures, and for me, the appeal just is based purely in the fact that the character's fluid enough to change and to reflect the times.
Chip Kidd.
It's hard for me to say. I know what I like about the character, what appeals to me. I truly don't know. I think because it's a fictional entity, Batman is a fictional entity. What does that mean? That means he's only as good or as interesting or as effective as whoever is manipulating him. So I think Frank Miller's Batman is fantastic and touches me on all sorts of different levels. There are a lot of people's versions of Batman that I wouldn't give you 5 cents for. And then there's everything in between. So I think it will endure as long as talented, interesting people are writing and drawing and producing his exploits.
Grant Morrison.
I think there's got to be more. I mean, people say that these things are power fantasies or wish fulfillments. I mean, there is that aspect, but I think there's definitely more to it. I mean, it's primal. Nobody would necessarily want to be Batman. Nobody wants to have their parents shot dead in front of them and have to spend 15 years learning how to fight crime. It retains its appeal precisely because it can be changed all the time. Sometimes people will like it because it's light and stupid, and sometimes people will like it because it's dark and frightening. And for me, the appeal just is based purely in the fact that the character's fluid enough to change.
Maybe it's just that he looks cool and is the good guy. A particularly American good guy who wants to make the world a better place. His kind of place. Oh, and of course he wants to look good while he's at it.
He looks cool and he keeps you safe, or he makes you feel safe. Looks cool and makes you feel safe. And maybe that is it. He looks like, you know, he's not the kind of guy you'd want to hang around with necessarily. But you would feel safe in Gotham City when Batman is around. I see him as a kind of protector figure, kind of father figure. A strict, stern father, perhaps. But he, as a kind of myth, he'd be not always there. He can kind of, you know, he's all over the city. He is the city, protecting its citizens and looking cool.
I'm Phil Jupiters, and this was Happy Birthday, Batman.
Happy Birthday, Batman was written and produced by Julian Carey.